This week on Making Contact.
And I say it clearly, I am doing this because I am seeking justice. Because an injustice was done on me. Because thousands have been tortured and killed in El Salvador. And I want an answer.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Carlos Mauricio also believed this to be a universal truth, even when his life unexpectedly plunged into darkness 20 years ago. He was one of the few political prisoners who survived the most brutal period of military repression in El Salvador. More than 75,000 people died, and countless others were tortured or disappeared from 1979 to 1992. On this edition, correspondent John Watanabe chronicles Carlos's remarkable journey in search of justice and ultimately healing for himself and his country. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information.
My name is Carlos Mauricio. I was born February 14th, 1952, in Ahuachapán, El Salvador. I am the third of four children born to a single mother. Ahuachapán is a little town located in the west side of El Salvador. My mother was a smuggler. She did her business selling merchandise in Guatemala and back to San Salvador, back to Ahuachapán. I began to take classes in 1959. I went to first grade in 1959. For a reason that I do not understand, the idea of coming to school, the idea of getting education, it is very, very important for me.
Carlos passionately pursued his education, graduating from high school and moving on to the National University of El Salvador. He began his teaching career while he was still a student at the university.
In 1977, I began teaching high school. I taught mathematics, physics, and algebra. And in 1979, when I got my degree from the University of El Salvador, I was given a full-time teaching assistant position.
In the fall of 1980, Carlos received a scholarship to travel to Mexico and pursue his master's degree at the University of Mérida. After years of increasing opposition to the government, a civil war had begun in El Salvador in late 1979. Two of the more well-known events of the civil war occurred in 1980. Archbishop Oscar Romero was assassinated shortly after giving a speech begging the government to stop the repression. And the four American churchwomen were raped and murdered after being stopped at a roadblock outside of San Salvador. An estimated 30,000 civilians were murdered by the military between 1979 and 1982. This was the political climate that existed in El Salvador when Carlos returned from Mexico with his master's degree.
When I came back, I saw people being captured. I saw bodies being dumped on the streets after being cruelly tortured. And I heard from my coworkers the horror of the repression that the government carried out against the people at that particular time. I learned that many of my friends and many of my coworkers, they were either killed or disappeared.
Carlos began teaching at the university and was given other administrative tasks as well. He had worked very hard to get to this point in his life, and his academic career was clearly on the rise. On June 13, 1983, as he was preparing to teach a class, a man walked into his classroom and asked him to move his car because it was blocking his. Carlos didn't realize it at the time, but his life was about to be changed forever.
I left the classroom in the middle of the street. I noticed something strange. I noticed that my car was not blocking other car. When I got suspicious of this situation, I looked back, and the guy was behind me about to grab me. So in the middle of the street, and at that particular moment, I realized that they were a special unit of the army coming for me. When I realized that, I tried to run back to the building where I felt I was safe. However, other men blocked my way back. And as I began to run from them, I realized also that eventually it was useless. So I grabbed the bumper of a Volkswagen. Immediately they surrounded me and began to hit me. And I was crying for help. I was just loudly saying, "Help me, help me." So I was there basically glued to the bumper of this car. And the guys came up with the butts of their rifles. They immediately began to beat me. And they beat my hands. When I fall to the ground, they kicked me and hit me with the butts of their rifles. They dragged me to a waiting car. I was blindfolded and I was handcuffed. As they drive me away, I knew that they were going to kill me.
Carlos was instead driven around for 3 or 4 hours and then delivered to a building, still handcuffed and blindfolded.
Somebody pushed me through a stairs going up. And I remember that I got the idea of a narrow hall. And I do remember that I step over other bodies, dead or alive. I didn't know. When I step over the bodies, I remember that the smell that I sense, the smell that I got, is the smell of death. And I was left standing up there, handcuffed and blindfolded. And I started to hear the cries of the people being tortured.
Carlos was soon moved into a torture chamber himself. His captors began by interrogating him about his opposition to the government. And although Carlos readily admitted to being a member of the unarmed opposition, he was beaten because he refused to admit to being a guerrilla. Carlos was punched, kicked, and repeatedly hit with what he believes was a metal bar wrapped in rubber. The daily routine for the prisoners was to be left alone during the day and to be tortured at night. Carlos has some vivid memories of what he saw while he was waiting to be tortured.
Although I was blindfolded, I was able to look down and through the space between my cheekbone and the blindfold, because they made me stand up for days and nights. From my higher position, I was able to see people lying in the ground, badly, badly tortured, broken bones or bleeding.
After 8 days and nights in the torture chamber, Carlos was moved to another part of the prison international police refer to as the common cells. His handcuffs and blindfold were finally removed, and he was placed in a cell with 11 other people. Late one night, a group of prisoners, including Carlos, was transferred to another part of the prison.
The police came and moved us, the prisoners, around 14 guys, to the underground. They moved us to a very, very hidden place. I passed by and I saw a woman that she saw her son, a 14 or 16 years old young boy. And I remember that through the bars, she held his hand and gave him a piece of cheese, probably something to eat. He had been kept with no food for I don't know how many weeks, probably. And the only edible thing that she got, she gave it to her son. I remember that it was the only moment that I cried in jail. You know, it's a matter of being macho, that tortured want to give you the maximum pain and then breaks you in cry. And then, you know, a way to break in your stand as a man. But I remember that I never cried. However, when I saw this woman doing that. I cried.
Later that morning, Carlos and his group were returned to the common cell area. After a total of 3 days there, Carlos was released, much to his surprise. However, he was given a chilling warning as he left.
A guard told me that I was a very, very lucky man. He said, better you leave the country, because next time we are going to kill you immediately.
And although Carlos emerged from the National Police Headquarters with lacerations and contusions, a broken tooth, broken ribs, and permanent damage to the vision in one eye, he was most shocked at his mental state.
The trauma that I carried out, I was numbed completely. I didn't get the whole idea of my trauma, the whole idea of being kidnapped and being tortured.
Haunted by the guard's warning, Carlos soon made plans to attend the university in Louvain, Belgium, and pursue his PhD. In Mexico, on the way to Europe, Carlos suddenly felt a strong desire to see his family. So instead of flying to Belgium, Carlos flew to Miami and rode a Greyhound bus to San Francisco to visit his sister, Maria Elena. The refuge he found in San Francisco felt so good that he decided to stay.
I got a job as a dishwasher. In the meantime, I took classes of English. After I managed some English, then I began to search for a decent job.
He eventually got a degree in genetic engineering with a master's in education and his teaching credentials. It was while at San Francisco State University that Carlos met Professor Felix Khoury, who told him about a lawsuit being filed by the Center for Justice and Accountability against two Salvadoran generals and encouraged Carlos to consider joining the case. The lawsuit against the generals was filed under two different laws, the Alien Tort Claims Act and the Torture Victim Protection Act. These are similar laws that give the survivors of egregious human rights abuses, wherever they are committed, the right to sue the responsible parties in U.S. federal court. Sean Roberts, a well-respected international human rights lawyer based in San Francisco, explains the fundamental origins of these laws.
The reason these laws exist is that there is a consensus that there are some crimes that are so egregious that those who perpetrate them are considered to be enemies of all mankind and should be able to be brought to accountability wherever it is that they're found.
Carlos didn't immediately join the case because he had concerns for the safety of his family in El Salvador. He was also very apprehensive about his ability to speak about his experiences in front of other people. He had never spoken to anyone about his torture. He had never even discussed it with his wife of 5 years, Ruth Good. After 2 weeks of soul searching, Carlos made a decision.
I decided to join the case because I think that in order to find some healing in the trauma that every person who has been tortured has, it is very important to confront the perpetrators. It is very important to have a day in court. And in a way, in the name of the other people killed or tortured, I wanted to come and tell the militaries that they were responsible for the genocide carried out against the Salvadorian people.
We'll continue with Carlos Mauricio's journey to justice in a moment. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. For CD or cassette copies of this program, please call 800 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org.
Generals Jose Garcia and Eugenio Vitas Casanova were successive ministers of defense between 1979 and 1983. These men were leading the military during the years of the most brutal repression of El Salvador's 12-year civil war. Both men had received Legion of Merit awards from the United States government when they retired. Both also had ties to the School of the Americas, America's controversial combat training school for Latin American soldiers based in Fort Benning, Georgia. Garcia had attended the counterinsurgency program, and Vitas Casanova had been a guest speaker. Bill Ford, brother of Ida Ford, one of the American churchwomen, was not surprised when he discovered these facts investigating the murder of his sister.
Well, unfortunately, the American government has been handing out these Legion of Merit awards to bad people for years on the theory that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. We were also not surprised that they had an association with the School of the Americas, because that school has a sorry history of training Central American military to efficiently make war on their own people.
Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the School of the Americas Watch, says that thousands of Salvadorians passed through the halls of the School of the Americas during the 12-year Salvadorian Civil War.
We have over 7,000 who trained here. In combat, in commando operations, counterinsurgency, you know, among the over 60,000 who have been trained here from throughout Latin America. We learned that from 1982 through 91, there were these manuals at the School of the Americas that advocated executions and torture.
Both of Carlos's fellow plaintiffs in the case, Dr. Juan Romagosa and Neris Gonzalez, suffered unspeakable torture at the hands of the military. Dr. Romagosa was deeply committed to providing medical services for the underprivileged in rural El Salvador. Neris Gonzalez was a church worker who was also dedicated to helping the rural poor. In May of 1999, CJA filed its case, which would be known as Romagosa v. Garcia and Vitas Casanova. On the same day, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights out of New York filed a case on behalf of the American churchwomen, which would be known as Ford v. Garcia and Vitas Casanova. The Ford case went to trial first in West Palm Beach, Florida. In the Ford trial, the general's lawyer, Kurt Klaus, successfully presented a defense based on the alleged existence of complete chaos in El Salvador during the years the generals were in charge of the military. He claimed that the military was out of control and the generals were unaware of many of the incidents that happened during their command. Sean Roberts helped in the preparation of the Ford case and also attended the trial.
The jurors had difficulty with finding that the generals had effective control over the subordinates that had committed the crimes in that case. And as a result of this, they found that the generals were not liable. Those of us who worked on the case were really devastated by this finding.
After numerous delays, the Romagosa trial finally began in late June of 2002 in West Palm Beach, Florida, in the courtroom of Judge Daniel Hurley, the same judge who had presided over the Ford trial 18 months earlier. One major advantage that the Romagosa team had over the Ford team was that there were living survivors who would come to the courtroom and testify on their own behalf. Dr. Romagosa led off for the plaintiffs, testifying on the first day of the trial. In his testimony, which was difficult and highly emotional, Dr. Romagosa described in gruesome detail the torture he endured in his 22 days of captivity. Trained as a surgeon, Dr. Romagosa's fingers were wrapped in wire, and he was hung from the ceiling by those fingers. He suffered permanent nerve damage and has been unable to perform surgery since his torture. He was also beaten, burned with cigarettes, and subjected to electric shocks. 3 days later, it was Carlos's turn to testify. Carlos spent many difficult and painful hours on the witness stand, recounting the horror of his kidnap and torture. but it was during cross-examination by the general's lawyer, Kurt Klaus, that the moment he had been waiting many years for arrived. Klaus asked Carlos what his motivation was for suing the generals, tacitly implying that his motivation was monetary.
And I said clearly, I am doing this because I am seeking justice, because an injustice was done on me, because thousands have been tortured and killed in El Salvador, and I want an answer from General Vides Casanova here. I want him to answer me why he allowed what happened to me and to others. And I fingered him and told him, I want an answer from you. I want you to tell me.
Nerys Gonzalez was the last of the plaintiffs to testify. Her testimony was both riveting and deeply moving, frequently bringing the courtroom to tears. Nerys described in detail how she was burned with cigarettes, cut with razor blades, subjected to electric shocks, and gang raped every single night of her 2-week captivity, despite the fact that she was 8 months pregnant. She also told the jury of how she was made to watch a young man's execution and then forced to drink his blood. And finally, she testified how 2 National Guardsmen balanced a bed frame on her pregnant belly and stood on either end. Her son suffered multiple injuries and died 2 months after he was born. On July 11th, the generals took the stand. They presented the same defense they used in the Ford trial, which was the alleged existence of complete chaos throughout El Salvador. They insisted there were many events that they were unaware of and that the military was out of control. Many expert witnesses testified on behalf of the plaintiffs. Stanford political science professor Terry Carl was particularly effective. In selecting Nerys, Juan, and Carlos, the legal team had chosen 3 people who represented groups highly targeted by the military. Doctors, church workers, and educators, particularly those who worked with peasants, were at the top of the military hit list. Professor Carl explained the targeting of these groups and showed that the military's actions were very specific and systematic and not random or chaotic at all. She also provided statistics that showed that human rights violations always dropped before a congressional vote on U.S. aid to El Salvador and resumed shortly thereafter, directly contradicting the defense's claims that the military was out of control. After closing arguments and jury instructions, the jury retired to deliberate on Thursday, July 18th, 2002. At 12:45 p.m. on Tuesday the 23rd, the call came notifying the lawyers that a verdict had been reached. The plaintiffs, the lawyers, and the entire support staff convened in Judge Hurley's chambers at 1:30. The judge made his entrance, and the jury was brought in. The verdict forms were presented to the judge, who looked them over and gave them to the bailiff to read. The courtroom fell silent. It was a silence filled with tension and anticipation.
The particular moment in which the verdict was about to be read, it was incredible. I hold Nerys's hand so tightly. That was the moment that I have been looking for years and years. A moment in which I may find some justice.
We were holding hands, bracing ourselves for the worst, hoping for the best. And the jurors walked in to the courtroom, and when they walked in, they didn't look at the plaintiffs. And as a result, I turned to the person next to me and I said, "Oh, we lost." And she in turn motioned that I should look at the bailiff, because as she explained to me later, she could see that he was holding back a smile. With the first finding of responsibility that General Garcia was in fact liable for the torture of Plaintiff Romagosa, there was a collective gasp in the courtroom. And then those of us who had long been involved in the case began to cry.
When I heard the verdict, I began to weep. You know, I cried always. It was not new that I was weeping when I heard that those generals were found responsible. So that feeling of justice achieved, that feeling of at last we have gotten something, that feeling of the killed and the tortured and the kidnapped are present in this second. They have been heard. That was very important.
In a stunning and sweeping victory for the plaintiffs, the jury found the generals responsible in each case and awarded the plaintiffs a total of $54.6 million in punitive and compensatory damages. It was a verdict that was hailed by the people of El Salvador and human rights activists around the world. Carlos soon returned to San Francisco, where there were many celebrations and endless requests for interviews. In the months that have followed, his life has returned to a semblance of normalcy, but those closest to him insist that he's a different person. Ruth Good, Carlos's wife.
The changes that have taken place in Carlos have been kind of incremental, but yes, Carlos is profoundly changed. He is lighter, he is happier.
After the trial, it is clear for me that horrible part of my life is left behind, that the suffering and the horrible things made on me on prison is the past. I got the feeling that now I have to move on.
Carlos is currently much in demand as a public speaker, speaking about human rights and torture, speaking to total strangers about a subject that was once impossible for him to talk about. But most importantly for Carlos, 5 weeks after the trial ended, he was able to resume his career as an educator. A little over 19 years after he left his university classroom to move his car to help a stranger, his life came full circle when he walked into his new classroom, introduced himself, and began taking roll.
Angelina?
Yes.
Teresa?
Here.
Yara?
Yes. For Making Contact, this is John Watanabe.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio, saxophone music by Francis Wong. For cassette or CD copy of the program, Journey to Justice, Carlos Mauricio's Story, program number 50, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, production intern Lindsay Goldsmith, Peggy Law founding director, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national advisor David Barsamian, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.